The Push by Ashley Audrin took the literary world by storm when it debuted, quickly becoming a #1 international bestseller and earning spots on numerous best books lists. This psychological thriller about the dark side of motherhood resonated deeply with readers, including celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow, who called it a provocative, compulsive read. The novel taps into primal fears about parenting, heredity, and the question many mothers secretly ask themselves, what if I don't love my child? What if something is wrong with them? Audrin's unflinching exploration of maternal ambivalence struck a chord in our culture that typically glorifies motherhood, making it a book club favorite and sparking important conversations about the complexities of mother-child relationships. Blythe Connor's family history weaves a dark tapestry of maternal dysfunction spanning three generations. Her grandmother Etta's story begins dramatically on September 1, 1939, the day Hitler invaded Poland, setting the stage for a legacy of trauma that would echo through decades. After a whirlwind romance with Louis, a charismatic farmer who represented hope and normalcy, Etta faces devastating loss when he dies in a horrific farming accident while she's 8 months pregnant. Forced to give birth alone during a brutal Kentucky snowstorm, Etta experiences what modern psychiatrists would likely identify as severe postpartum depression, complicated by grief and isolation. Though she later marries Henry, a kind man who provides stability and financial security, the fundamental connection between mother and child remains irreparably damaged. The psychological wounds inflicted by this broken beginning manifests in increasingly disturbing ways as Cecilia grows up. Etta's abuse of her daughter takes many forms, from emotional neglect to outright sadism. The pickle cellar incident stands as a particularly haunting example. 7-year-old Cecilia, terrified of the dark, is forced into the dank underground space to retrieve a doll, only to have her mother lock the door and forget her for hours. Even more horrifying is the bathtub episode, where Etta holds her daughter underwater until bubbles stop rising, pulling her up at the last possible moment. These aren't merely acts of cruelty, but reveal a profound psychological break. Etta seems to view her daughter not as a precious being to protect, but as a threat or burden to be controlled. This trauma creates deep fissures in Cecilia's psyche that surface when she becomes a mother herself. Unable to form healthy attachments, she maintains an emotional distance from young Blythe that eventually becomes physical abandonment. Her brutal honesty about her maternal shortcomings, "she doesn't need me" and "she'd be better off if I wasn't her mother," reflects both self-awareness and a crushing inability to break the cycle. When Cecilia reinvents herself as Annie and builds a new life with Richard, she appears to flourish, presenting 12-year-old Blythe with the cruel paradox of a mother who can only thrive in her absence. The intergenerational transmission of trauma raises complex questions about the nature of maternal love and attachment. The novel explores whether maternal instinct is truly innate, or if it's a learned behavior that can be irreparably damaged by early experiences. Through detailed flashbacks and parallel narratives, we see how patterns of dysfunction repeat themselves, each generation of women struggling with their maternal role in ways that echo their own childhood wounds. Cecilia's poignant admission to young Blythe, "I don't want you learning to be like me, but I don't know how to teach you to be anyone different," encapsulates the tragic helplessness of wanting to break a cycle without having the tools to do so. The story suggests that while genetic predisposition may play a role in maternal capability, environmental factors and childhood experiences profoundly shape how women approach motherhood. Each generation's trauma creates ripple effects that influence not just their immediate relationships, but the emotional heritage they pass down to their children. Cecilia's poignant admission to young Blythe, "I don't want you learning to be like me, but I don't know how to teach you to be anyone different," encapsulates the tragic helplessness of wanting to break a cycle without having the tools to do so. When we first meet Blythe and Fox Connor, they appear to have the perfect relationship. Their courtship unfolds like a romantic film. Fox arrives at her door with fresh flowers, remembers tiny details about her preferences, and plans elaborate dates that show thoughtful consideration. He's attentive, supportive, and seemingly flawless, calling her daily and writing sweet notes that Blythe keeps in a special box. Blythe's friend Grace even asks what's wrong with him because he seems too good to be true, warning that no one is that perfect. Their early marriage is blissful, filled with late dinners of homemade pasta, afternoon wine on their small balcony, and passionate intimacy that makes them feel like the only two people in the world. But beneath this carefully constructed veneer lies Blythe's desperate need to appear perfect. She meticulously curates their home, obsesses over dinner parties, and maintains an immaculate appearance. More significantly, she hides her dysfunctional family history, ashamed of her absent father who disappeared when she was 8, and the mother who abandoned her, leaving only a note on the kitchen counter. "I couldn't risk you knowing how broken my family was," she confesses to Fox years later. This performance of perfection becomes Blythe's defense mechanism. If she can be the ideal wife, perhaps she can escape her mother's legacy and prove she's nothing like the women who came before her. The facade begins to crack when their daughter Violet is born. As Blythe struggles with motherhood, Fox's supportive nature gradually erodes. He dismisses her increasingly frantic concerns about Violet's behavior, the way she stares too long, her unusual silence around other children, her seeming pleasure in others' pain. Fox blames Blythe's anxiety for the child's difficulties, creating a pattern of gaslighting that makes her question her own perceptions. "You're anxious. She can sense it," he tells her when Violet won't stop crying, despite hours of attempted soothing. When Blythe neglects Violet to work on her writing, Fox's anger reveals his conditional love. "I'm worried for her," he says, suggesting Blythe needs professional help while undermining her concerns about their daughter. Their relationship deteriorates further after their son Sam's tragic death. Fox grows distant, working late hours and avoiding emotional conversations. He eventually has an affair with his assistant Gemma, leading to divorce and a new family, complete with the stepson Violet always wanted. The slow death of their marriage happens in small, deliberate ways. Long pauses before answering simple questions, closed bathroom doors that were once open, bringing home one coffee instead of two, separate bedtimes, and meals eaten in silence. These subtle shifts reveal how fragile their connection truly was, built on appearances rather than authentic understanding. What makes this portrait of marriage so devastating is how it contrasts with Blythe's initial hopes and society's idealized version of love. She believed Fox's love could save her from her mother's legacy, but instead, he abandons her when she needs him most, during her darkest moments of grief and self-doubt. Their story suggests that perfect love is an illusion. Lasting relationships require honesty about our flaws and traumas, not performance and pretense. The pressure to maintain an image of domestic bliss ultimately contributes to their downfall, showing how the pursuit of perfection can destroy the very thing it aims to protect. "I remember exactly what life was like before our own Violet came," Blythe reflects, describing the carefree existence she and Fox enjoyed before parenthood. Their days flowed with an easy rhythm, spontaneous weekend trips, lingering conversations over coffee, late dinners with friends that stretched into the early morning hours. They drank afternoon wine on their balcony, maintained passionate intimacy, and built their lives around their own desires and schedules. Life was less visceral, with ideas brighter and words coming easier. Their marriage existed in a space of possibility and freedom, unmarked by the weight of responsibility that lay ahead. When Blythe becomes pregnant, she's consumed with excitement and anticipation, immersing herself in pregnancy books and nursery preparations. She can't write anymore because her mind is filled with thoughts of her daughter, imagining first steps, first words, tender bedtime moments. She feels a secret pride in her changing body, touching her growing belly with wonder, and imagines the profound connection she'll have with her child. These expectations reflect society's idealized vision of motherhood, a natural, joyful transformation that fulfills a woman's deepest purpose. Baby showers and prenatal classes reinforce this narrative, presenting motherhood as a seamless transition into a more meaningful life. Reality crashes in with Violet's birth with brutal force. The physical toll is immediate and intense. Breasts like cement, razor blade gums on nipples, and bloodstained sheets. Her body becomes foreign territory, leaking, aching, desperately sleep-deprived. More disturbing is Blythe's emotional response. Instead of the promised maternal bliss, she feels dread and disconnection. When Violet cries incessantly, Blythe thinks, "Please, go away." She observes that, "Violet cried only when she was with me. It felt like a betrayal. We were supposed to want each other." The natural bonding she expected refuses to materialize, leaving her trapped in a spiral of guilt and inadequacy. This gap between expectation and reality extends to Blythe's social experience. When she tentatively suggests to a mother's group that motherhood is difficult, they quickly assert it's all worth it without showing any vulnerability. Their Instagram-perfect lives, featuring sleeping babies and peaceful nursing sessions, make Blythe feel even more isolated in her scuggles. The mothers trade tips about sleep training and organic baby food while carefully avoiding any mention of depression, anxiety, or ambivalence. Only once does she meet another mother who admits motherhood feels like something that happened to us rather than an accomplishment, a rare moment of honesty that briefly breaks through the facade. The novel powerfully illustrates how cultural mythology around motherhood sets women up for feelings of inadequacy and failure. Modern society presents a sanitized version of motherhood. Glossy magazine covers of glowing pregnant women, social media posts of peaceful nurseries, and endless advice about natural mothering instincts. By portraying Blythe's raw, unfiltered experience, Audrain challenges the notion that maternal love is automatic and universal. Instead, she suggests motherhood is complex, sometimes ambivalent, and profoundly influenced by our own childhood experiences. The pressure to conform to idealized expectations only deepens the isolation of mothers who struggle, creating a conspiracy of silence around the darker aspects of maternal experience. Perhaps the most taboo aspect of The Push is its unflinching portrayal of maternal ambivalence, the simultaneous experience of love and hatred toward one's child. From Violet's earliest days, Blythe struggles to feel the connection that supposedly comes naturally to mothers. She observes that Violet melted into your skin, while my warmth and smell meant nothing to her, as though I were a foreign country despite carrying her in my womb. This disconnect evolves into something darker as Violet grows. Blythe notices disturbing behaviors. Violet refuses to be held, seems to prefer Fox, and displays what Blythe perceives as calculated coldness. When Violet's preschool teacher reports that she twisted a boy's fingers until he cried and stabbed another child with a pencil, Blythe's worst fears seem confirmed. The novel forces readers to confront uncomfortable questions. What if a mother doesn't love her child? What if she believes something is fundamentally wrong with her child? These thoughts plague Blythe, who admits, "These are thoughts I never spoke aloud, thoughts most mothers don't have." Her shame and isolation deepen as she keeps these feelings secret. Audrain masterfully creates ambiguity around whether Violet is truly disturbed or if Blythe's perception is clouded by her own trauma and expectations. When neighborhood boy Elijah dies after falling from playground equipment, Blythe believes she saw Violet deliberately trip him. Later, when Sam dies after his stroller rolls into traffic, Blythe is convinced Violet pushed it. Yet both incidents lack conclusive evidence, leaving readers to wonder if Blythe's is an unreliable narrator. This ambiguity reaches its climax when Blythe confronts Violet years later. Standing outside Fox's house on Christmas Eve, Blythe thinks she sees Violet mouth the words, "I push him," seeming to confirm her suspicions about Sam's death. But this moment remains uncertain. Did Violet actually confess, or is Blythe seeing what she needs to believe? By exploring maternal ambivalence so thoroughly, Audrain challenges the cultural taboo against mothers expressing negative feelings toward their children. She suggests that acknowledging these complex emotions might be healthier than denying them, and that the pressure to feel only love can intensify feelings of failure and isolation. The stark difference in Blythe's relationship with her two children forms one of the novel's most poignant threads. With Violet, motherhood feels like an endless struggle. Blythe describes the first 6 months as feeling like 6 years, with days that rolled like boulders into one another. She focuses merely on survival rather than joy, counting the hours until each day ends. Everything changes with Sam's birth. From the moment he emerges, Blythe feels an instant connection. He was my miracle. Unlike with Violet, breastfeeding Sam brings tears of love rather than pain. She describes him as 7 pounds of something so pure, so blissful, it felt like he might float away, a dream I could never deserve. The contrast is stark and immediate. With Sam, Blythe finally experiences the maternal bond she'd longed for. He would lift his head from between my breasts, wobbling as he searched for me, and when I put my cheek to his, he would rest again, safe, happy, full of milk and me. This connection transforms her, making her feel complete in a way she never did with Violet. Fox notices this difference, telling his mother, "She loves that boy. I just wish she felt that same way about Violet." This observation highlights the painful reality that maternal love isn't always equal or automatic. Sometimes it flows easily with one child, but requires effort with another. The contrast becomes even more heartbreaking after Sam's death. Blythe's grief is all-consuming, while her relationship with Violet deteriorates further. She admits to sometimes wishing that he and I were alone without her, and even has the terrible thought that she wishes it had been Violet who was pushed off the slide instead of neighborhood boy Elijah. This painful exploration of preferential love challenges the myth that mothers naturally love all their children equally. Instead, Audrin suggests that some parent-child relationships simply fit better naturally, while others require more conscious effort and work. This honest portrayal offers validation to parents who struggle with similar feelings while raising profound questions about the nature of maternal love. Throughout The Push, Audrain masterfully blurs the line between objective reality and Blythe's potentially distorted perception. This ambiguity centers primarily on Violet's behavior. Is she truly disturbed, or is Blythe projecting her fears onto an ordinary child? Evidence supporting Blythe's concerns includes reports from Violet's preschool teacher about her hurting other children and showing no remorse. Blythe finds a fistful of a boy's hair in Violet's dress pocket after Violet announced her intention to hurt him. Most disturbingly, Blythe believes she saw Violet deliberately trip Elijah on the playground before his fatal fall and later push Sam's stroller into traffic. Yet, alternative explanations exist for each incident. The preschool behaviors could be normal childhood aggression. The hair could have come from helping clean up, as Violet claims. Most significantly, when Blythe revisits the intersection where Sam died, she notices the curb has a steeper slope than she remembered, suggesting the stroller might have rolled naturally without being pushed. Other characters consistently see Violet differently than Blythe does. Fox defends his daughter blindly, insisting there's nothing wrong with her. His mother, Helen, acknowledges Violet has a bit of a temper, but otherwise seems to enjoy a normal relationship with her granddaughter. Even Gemma, Fox's new wife, forms a loving bond with Violet, telling Blythe directly, "She didn't push Sam. I know you believe she did, but you've made it up." This uncertainty extends to Blythe's own mental state. Her family history of maternal dysfunction creates a lens through which she views her relationship with Violet. She admits to sometimes putting on headphones and pretending Violet doesn't exist, behavior that echoes her own mother's neglect. After Sam's death, her grief becomes all-consuming, potentially further distorting her perception. The novel's brilliant final scene maintains this ambiguity. When Blythe thinks she sees Violet mouth, "I push him," through the window, readers must decide whether this is a genuine confession or Blythe's desperate need for confirmation of what she believes. The truth remains elusive, forcing readers to sit with the uncomfortable possibility that there may be no single objective reality. This narrative strategy makes The Push so compelling. It places readers in Blythe's position of uncertainty, questioning what is real and what is imagined. It suggests that perception itself shapes our relationships and experiences, sometimes creating self-fulfilling prophecies.
The Push presents a haunting portrait of how trauma passes from one generation to the next. This cycle begins with Etta, whose mental health issues lead her to abuse her daughter, Cecilia. These experiences shape Cecilia into a woman incapable of mothering her own daughter, Blythe, perpetuating the pattern of maternal dysfunction. Blythe is acutely aware of this legacy. When she becomes pregnant, she vows to be different. "I would be different from my own mother. I would be everything she was not." Yet, despite her determination, she struggles to bond with Violet, finding herself repeating some of her mother's behaviors: emotional distance, occasional neglect, and intrusive thoughts about escaping motherhood. The novel suggests that breaking this cycle requires conscious awareness and effort. Blythe tries therapy, joins mothers' groups, and forces herself to engage in activities with Violet. Yet her efforts often feel mechanical rather than natural. "We kept busy and I kept quiet." The underlying disconnection remains, suggesting that intention alone isn't enough to overcome deeply ingrained patterns. Sam's birth offers Blythe a temporary escape from this cycle. With him, she experiences the natural maternal bond that eluded her with Violet. This suggests that the cycle isn't inevitable. Under different circumstances, with a different child, Blythe can be the mother she aspired to be. Yet, this breakthrough proves tragically temporary with Sam's death. The novel's most poignant exploration of this theme comes when Blythe imagines an alternative reality with Violet, one where they share a loving, connected relationship. "She nurses until she turns one. I'm fueled by her hot skin against mine. I'm happy, grateful, not crying when I'm near her." This fantasy reveals Blythe's deep longing to break the cycle while acknowledging her failure to do so. By the novel's end, the cycle threatens to continue into the next generation. The final scene reveals that something has happened to Jet, Fox and Gemma's son, raising the chilling possibility that Violet may be perpetuating the family's legacy of harm. This suggests that intergenerational trauma doesn't just affect the mother-child relationship, but can spread outward to impact others. Through this multi-generational portrait, Audrain offers a nuanced view of how trauma perpetuates itself. While not absolving individuals of responsibility for their actions, she illustrates how profoundly our capacity to parent is shaped by how we ourselves were parented. This compassionate perspective invites readers to consider how patterns of harm might be interrupted before they claim more victims. Despite its darkness, The Push ultimately offers a tentative path toward healing. After years of blaming Violet for Sam's death and struggling with her own maternal inadequacy, Blythe begins a journey toward acceptance and recovery. This process begins when Blythe revisits the intersection where Sam died. Examining the curb more carefully, she realizes it has a steeper slope than she remembered, suggesting the stroller might have rolled naturally without being pushed. This physical detail forces her to question her certainty about Violet's guilt. Could it have rolled so far without a push? Had she touched that handle? When the coffee shop owner mentions how Violet clung to your waist and wanted to be held after the accident, behavior inconsistent with Blythe's perception of her daughter, she must confront the possibility that her grief has distorted her memory. Blythe's healing continues as she gradually acknowledges her own role in the family dysfunction. When she tells Violet, "I want you to feel loved by someone you trust, and that person doesn't have to be me if you don't want it to be," she shows growth in prioritizing her daughter's emotional needs over her own desire for connection. This represents a significant break from the self-centered parenting she experienced from her own mother. The novel's epilogue, set a year and a half later, shows Blythe actively working on her mental health. She practices meditation and breathing exercises with her therapist. She repeats affirmations: "I am capable of moving beyond my mistakes. I am able to heal from the hurt and pain I have caused." Though her joys remain measured, she allows herself small pleasures like music and movement. Most significantly, she turns on the front light in case her daughter decides it's finally time to see her, showing her continued hope for reconciliation. This path toward healing isn't portrayed as easy or complete. Blythe still struggles with grief and guilt. The novel's final line, Gemma's hysterical call about something happening to Jet, suggests new trauma may be unfolding. Yet Blythe has developed tools to face whatever comes next with greater awareness and resilience than she possessed before. By ending with this tentative healing rather than complete resolution, Audrain offers a realistic portrayal of recovery from trauma. She suggests that while we may never fully escape our past or repair all broken relationships, we can learn to live with greater self-awareness and acceptance. This nuanced message provides hope without minimizing the lasting impact of family trauma.